Here is the full transcript of the podcast episode discussing the research paper application of Zigbee technology and neural network algorithm in street lamp control system. Hello and welcome to the Research Report, the podcast that takes you deep into the heart of cutting-edge research. I'm Tom, and joining me as always is my co-host, Jen.
Hi there, listeners. Today we're diving into a fascinating paper that explores the use of Zigbee technology and neural network algorithms in street lamp control systems. The title of the paper is Application of Zigbee Technology and Neural Network Algorithm in Street Lamp Control System, and it was authored by researchers at Shandong Agricultural University in China.
This is a really interesting intersection of wireless communication, smart city infrastructure, and advanced algorithms. The researchers set out to develop an improved street lamp control system that could optimize energy efficiency and responsiveness, using Zigbee networking and neural networks.
That's right, Tom. The key goals were to create a more flexible, adaptive, and intelligent street lighting system compared to traditional microcontroller-based approaches. Let's dive in and see how they went about it.
The paper starts by providing some context on the development and current state of street lamp control systems. Traditionally, these systems have relied on microcontrollers paired with various sensors, like light and motion detectors, to turn the lamps on and off and adjust their brightness.
The researchers note that while these basic systems can handle the core functionality, they have some limitations. The sensor inputs and control logic are often quite rigid, making it difficult to optimize energy usage or respond dynamically to changing conditions.
Exactly. The authors argue that there's a need for more advanced, flexible control systems that can intelligently adapt the street lighting based on factors like ambient light levels, pedestrian, vehicle traffic, time of day, weather conditions, and so on. This is where the Zigbee networking and neural network algorithms come into play.
Zigbee is a low-power wireless communication protocol that's well-suited for building mesh networks or distributed sensor nodes and control devices. The researchers explain how they leveraged Zigbee to create a decentralized system where each lamp node can communicate with its neighbors and coordinate lighting adjustments.
The neural network component is used to process all the sensor data and make intelligent decisions about optimal lighting levels. By training a neural net on historical usage patterns and environmental conditions, the system can learn to predict lighting needs and proactively adjust the lamps accordingly.
That's really fascinating. So instead of just reacting to immediate sensor inputs, the neural network allows the system to anticipate changes and get ahead of them. It can essentially learn the patterns and rhythms of a given area to optimize energy efficiency and responsiveness.
Right. And the paper goes into detail on how they implemented both the Zigbee networking and the neural network algorithms. For the Zigbee side, they used the IAR embedded workbench development environment to program the lamp nodes and configure the mesh network topology.
And for the neural network, they experimented with different architectures like feed-forward, radial basis function, and convolutional neural nets. The goal was to find the model that could best capture the complex relationships between all the sensor inputs and produce reliable lighting control decisions.
From what I gather, the researchers had to overcome some interesting challenges in getting this hybrid system to work effectively. Integrating the wireless communication, sensor data processing, and adaptive control logic into a cohesive, real-time street lighting system doesn't sound trivial.
Absolutely. One key hurdle was ensuring reliable and low-latency data transmission across the Zigbee mesh network, especially as the number of lamp nodes scaled up. They had to carefully optimize things like node placement, routing algorithms, and wireless channel usage.
And on the neural network side, they had to assemble large, representative datasets to train the models, experiment with different architectures and hyperparameters, and validate the accuracy and responsiveness of the lighting control decisions. It's an impressive technical accomplishment.
The paper presents some promising results from their prototype system. They were able to demonstrate significant energy savings compared to traditional streetlight controls, while maintaining appropriate lighting levels and responsive adaptation to changing conditions.
That's great to hear. It seems like this Zigbee and neural network approach could have some really compelling real-world applications for smart city infrastructure. Not only does it enable more efficient street lighting, but the underlying technology could potentially be expanded to other urban monitoring and control systems.
Definitely. I'm particularly interested in how the neural network component allows the system to learn and evolve over time. Rather than just following a static set of rules, it can continuously adapt its decision-making to changing patterns of usage and environmental factors.
That adaptive, self-learning capability is a key advantage. Rather than needing manual tuning and reconfiguration, the system can autonomously optimize itself. It's a great example of how AI and machine learning are enabling a new generation of intelligent, responsive infrastructure.
Absolutely. This research really highlights the potential of combining advanced networking, sensing, and algorithm technologies to create smart city systems that are more efficient, adaptive, and responsive to the needs of urban environments and citizens. It's an exciting glimpse into the future of urban infrastructure.
Definitely. This has been a fascinating deep dive into a really innovative piece of research. The researchers at Shandong Agricultural University have made some great strides in advancing street lamp control systems through the clever application of Zigbee and neural networks.
I agree, Tom. This is yet another example of how cutting-edge science and technology are converging to create solutions that can meaningfully improve our world. I'm excited to see how this work continues to evolve and get applied in real-world smart city deployments.
Absolutely. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us on the Research Report. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss our next episode where we'll be exploring another groundbreaking piece of research. Until next time, this is Tom,
Dot and Jen, signing off.
Jingle plays. Are your street lamps not as smart as you'd like? Tired of those outdated, energy-guzzling lights that just can't keep up with the modern world?
Well, have we got the solution for you? Introducing Zig Lamp, the world's first self-learning, AI-powered street lighting system.
Powered by advanced Zigbee mesh networking and cutting-edge neural networks, Zig Lamp knows exactly when and how bright to shine. No more wasteful, always on lights or unpredictable flickering.
Zig Lamp's neural brain monitors traffic patterns, weather conditions, and even the moon phases to keep your streets perfectly lit 24/7. It's like having a little lighting genius on every single pole.
And the best part? Zig Lamp installs in a snap using our revolutionary Zig plugs. Just screw M in and let the AI take over. No complicated wiring, no tedious programming. Zig Lamp does it all automatically.
So say goodbye to dumb street lamps and hello to the future of urban illumination. Get Zig Lamp today and watch your energy bills disappear into the night.
Zig Lamp. Lighting up the smart city of tomorrow. Jingle plays. Here is the complete podcast episode transcript. Intro music. Welcome to the Curious Minds podcast, where we dive deep into the latest scientific discoveries. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. In this episode, we'll be exploring a thought-provoking research paper that examines the implications of Indonesia's new criminal code on the authority of prosecutors to investigate corruption crimes.
The paper is titled Prosecutors' Authority in Investigating Corruption Crimes, Law No. 1 of 2023 comes into force. It was authored by Silpia Rosalina, Elidar Chadir, Anerdianto, and published in the Law and Humanities Quarterly Reviews.
This is a fascinating study that tackles a complex legal issue with huge real-world consequences. The new Indonesian Criminal Code, which went into effect in 2023, has reshuffled the investigative powers of different law enforcement agencies when it comes to corruption.
Specifically, the paper looks at whether prosecutors will still be able to investigate corruption crimes, or if that authority has now been stripped away. As you can imagine, this is a high-stakes issue that goes to the heart of the fight against corruption in Indonesia.
Absolutely. Corruption has long been a major problem plaguing Indonesia, and the prosecutor's office has historically played a key role in rooting it out. So the implications of this new law are hugely important. Let's dive into the details.
The researchers begin by providing some important context. They explain that the old Indonesian criminal code, which dated back to the Dutch colonial era, has finally been replaced with a new version. And this new code has brought some significant changes when it comes to corruption.
Specifically, the researchers note that several types of corruption crimes that were previously regulated separately have now been incorporated into the new criminal code. So corruption is no longer considered a special crime. It's now part of the general criminal code.
This shift raised immediate concerns about the impact on the prosecutor's investigative powers. You see, under the old system, prosecutors were granted special authority to investigate certain crimes, including corruption. But with corruption now classified as a general offense, there were questions about whether that investigative power would be rescinded.
The researchers dug into this issue in depth, analyzing the relevant laws and regulations, as well as drawing on interviews with leading Indonesian criminal law experts. And what they found was a somewhat complex and nuanced picture.
On one hand, the researchers confirm that the new criminal code does not explicitly revoke the prosecutor's authority to investigate corruption. The legal basis for this power, rooted in laws like the Prosecutor's Office Act, remains intact.
However, the experts they interviewed raised some thought-provoking concerns. As one scholar, Maris Ali from the University of Indonesia, explained, if the prosecutor is also an investigator, the system gets mixed up. By granting investigative authority, the prosecutor's burden becomes heavy. If the prosecutor becomes both an investigator and a public prosecutor, then where is the control?
In other words, there are valid questions about whether it's appropriate for prosecutors to serve as both investigators and trial attorneys. This dual role could create conflicts of interest and undermine the principle of checks and balances in the justice system.
Another expert, Cheryl Huda from the University of Muhammadiyah Jakarta, went even further. He argued that the prosecutor's investigative powers on corruption should be limited and clearly defined, rather than left open-ended. Otherwise, he warned, there's a risk of the criminalization of various ACTS that are said to be against the law, but are not ACTS of corruption.
Fascinating points. The researchers also highlighted some empirical data that sheds light on this issue. They noted that in recent years, the prosecutor's office has actually been taking on an increasing share of corruption investigations, compared to the police and the Corruption Eradication Commission.
That's a really interesting trend. It suggests that in practice, prosecutors have been leaning into this investigative role, even as the legal framework has remained somewhat murky. The researchers argue this is partly because the prosecutor's office is seen as more capable when it comes to tackling complex corruption cases.
Absolutely, and the researchers offer some concrete proposals for how to resolve this ambiguity going forward. They suggest clearly delineating the investigative powers of prosecutors versus police, based on factors like the location of the crime, the value of losses involved, and the seniority of the perpetrators.
That's a smart approach. By creating more defined boundaries, it could help prevent turf wars and ensure a more coordinated, efficient anti-corruption effort. The researchers also emphasize that even as the new criminal code brings changes, the special laws empowering prosecutors shouldn't be abandoned.
It's a nuanced and thoughtful analysis. The bottom line seems to be that prosecutors should retain investigative authority on corruption, but with some important caveats and limitations. Striking that right balance will be crucial as Indonesia continues its fight against endemic graft.
Definitely, this is a complex issue without any easy answers. But the researchers have done an excellent job of unpacking the key considerations and proposing constructive solutions. It's a fascinating look at the evolving legal landscape around corruption in Indonesia.
Agreed. This paper really highlights the importance of maintaining strong, independent institutions to tackle deep-seated problems like corruption. We can't afford to have these powers get muddled or diminished.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into this important research. It's a great reminder that even as laws change, the fundamental fight against corruption must remain a top priority. We'll be back soon with another fascinating look at cutting-edge science. Until then, keep exploring. Outro music.
Upbeat jingle. Are you tired of dodging corruption scandals and government red tape? Well, have we got the solution for you?
Introducing Corruption Busters, the one-stop shop for all your anti-corruption needs.
That's right. Corruption Busters is the brainchild of a team of legal experts and former prosecutors who saw a gap in the market.
With our cutting-edge corruption concierge service, we'll navigate the Byzantine bureaucracy and track down those shady officials for you.
Need to investigate a bribery ring? Tracking down embezzled funds? Corruption Busters has got your back.
Our elite team of corruption crusaders will use every trick in the book, from forensic accounting to secret surveillance, to bring those crooked crooks to justice.
And the best part? We'll handle all the red tape so you don't have to. Leave the dirty work to us and enjoy your squeaky clean conscience.
So what are you waiting for? Call Corruption Busters today at 1-800-NO-GRAFT. Together, we'll weed out corruption, one schmucky schemer at a time. Upbeat jingle intensifies.
Here is a detailed podcast transcript of an episode about the research paper South Korea's environmental securitization process in facing the impact of China's fine dust. Intro music. Welcome to the award-winning podcast where we investigate cutting-edge research with intrigue and depth. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. In this episode, we'll be diving into a fascinating paper on South Korea's strategic response to the environmental threat of fine dust pollution from China.
The paper is titled South Korea's Environmental Securitization Process in Facing the Impact of China's Fine Dust, and it was authored by Faradiba and Mansa Jund.
This research examines how South Korea has leveraged the process of securitization, transforming an environmental issue into a national security concern, to address the critical challenge of fine dust pollution. Through a blend of expert analysis and compelling storytelling, we'll unpack the complex dynamics at play.
South Korea has found itself on the front lines of an environmental crisis with far-reaching consequences. Fine dust, or PM2.5 particles, have been blowing across the border from China, contaminated with harmful pollutants and carcinogens. This has led to deteriorating air quality, elevated health risks, and significant economic costs for the country.
The paper traces how South Korea has strategically responded to this threat, moving beyond traditional environmental policy to adopt a securitization approach. By framing fine dust as an existential national security issue, the government has been able to justify and implement extraordinary measures to mitigate the crisis.
This is a fascinating case study that sheds light on the intersection of environmental challenges, geopolitics, and the wielding of state power. Let's dive in and explore how South Korea has navigated this complex situation. Transition music. Jen, the paper begins by providing some crucial context on the fine dust phenomenon in East Asia. Can you tell us more about the history and science behind this environmental problem?
Absolutely. Fine dust, or PM2.5, has long been a meteorological feature in the region, with dust storms blowing in from the deserts of Mongolia and China. This yellow sand phenomenon, known locally as Fongsa, has been part of the regional climate for centuries.
But the authors point out that in recent decades, public awareness and concern over fine dust have grown significantly. Why is that?
Well, the research highlights that while natural dust has always been present, the fine dust now carries a concerning new element, man-made pollution from China's industrialized regions. As this contaminated dust blows across the border into South Korea, it poses serious public health risks.
I see. So the composition of the fine dust has changed, making it a much greater threat than the natural yellow sand events of the past.
Exactly. Studies have shown that the fine dust particles now contain carcinogenic substances, primarily in the form of invisible nano-sized PM2.5 particles. This has significant implications for the health and well-being of South Koreans.
And the data paints a pretty alarming picture. The paper notes that air quality in Seoul, the capital of South Korea, has seen dramatic changes over the past two decades.
Yes, the figures are quite concerning. While PM10 levels have seen some fluctuations, the annual average concentration of PM2.5 has been consistently high, exceeding both South Korea's own air quality standards and the WHO's recommended levels.
In fact, the paper states that Seoul's air pollution challenges are worse than many other major cities around the world, reaching 1.4 to 2.8 times the levels of some global metropolises.
Absolutely. The health risks are substantial, especially for vulnerable populations like children and the elderly. This fine dust crisis has clearly evolved into a major public health issue for South Korea.
but as the researchers point out, the implications of this problem extend well beyond just public health. There are deeper geopolitical and environmental dynamics at play.
That's right. The paper delves into the complex relationship between China's economic policies, its role as a major contributor to global carbon emissions, and the transboundary nature of air pollution.
Can you unpack that a bit more? How do China's actions factor into South Korea's fine dust dilemma?
Well, the research highlights that China is the world's largest emitter of air pollutants, including the fine dust particles that are wreaking havoc in South Korea. Studies have shown a clear correlation between China's industrial activities and the deteriorating air quality in neighboring countries like South Korea.
So South Korea is essentially facing the negative environmental spillover effects of China's rapid industrialization and growth model. This creates a challenging dynamic between the two countries.
Exactly. The paper explains that China's policies and economic priorities have directly contributed to the fine dust crisis in South Korea. This has profound implications, not just for public health, but also for the broader environmental and diplomatic landscape in the region.
It's a complex, interconnected issue. And as the research highlights, South Korea has had to grapple with this challenge in a strategic and multifaceted way. This is where the concept of securitization comes into play.
Yes, the authors delve into how South Korea has utilized the process of securitization to address the fine dust problem. Can you explain what securitization entails and why it's a relevant lens for analyzing South Korea's approach?
Securitization is a fascinating political concept. Essentially, it involves transforming an issue that may have traditionally been seen as a social or environmental concern into a matter of national security. By portraying a problem as an existential threat to the state, governments can justify taking extraordinary measures to address it.
So in the context of South Korea's fine dust crisis, the government has strategically reframed this environmental issue as a national security concern. This allows them to implement more robust and far-reaching policies to mitigate the threat.
Exactly. The paper examines how South Korea has leveraged this securitization process to respond to the fine dust problem stemming from China. By depicting it as an urgent, existential threat, the government has been able to justify and implement complex diplomatic efforts and international agreements to curb the flow of harmful pollutants.
That's fascinating. Can you give us some concrete examples of how this securitization approach has manifested in South Korea's policies and actions?
One key example highlighted in the paper is the Blue Sky Project. This initiative, launched by the South Korean government, represents a comprehensive effort to address the fine dust crisis through diplomatic channels and international cooperation.
Ah yes, the Blue Sky Project. Can you tell us more about the specifics of this program and how it exemplifies South Korea's securitization strategy?
Absolutely. The Blue Sky Project was designed to leverage South Korea's diplomatic influence and forge international agreements to tackle the fine dust issue at its source, in China. By framing this as a national security concern, the government was able to justify spending significant resources and political capital on these collaborative efforts.
That's really intriguing. So rather than just focusing on domestic environmental regulations, South Korea recognized the need for a more holistic, cross-border approach to addressing the fine dust crisis.
Exactly. The paper highlights how South Korea has worked to strengthen its diplomatic ties with China, engaging in negotiations and information sharing to coordinate joint efforts to reduce emissions and mitigate the transboundary transport of fine dust particles.
It's a fascinating example of how securitization can empower a state to take unusual, yet necessary, measures to confront an environmental threat. The researchers really delve into the complex interplay between geopolitics, public health, and environmental policymaking.
Absolutely. And the paper doesn't stop there. It also examines how other factors, like media narratives, have influenced South Korea's securitization process and the public's perception of the fine dust crisis.
That's a really important point. The researchers explore how media coverage of the fine dust issue has the potential to shape public opinion and government response, sometimes in ways that don't entirely align with the actual scientific data.
Yes. The paper cites research showing that media reports on fine dust can influence people's behaviors and attitudes, even when the objective air quality measurements don't necessarily warrant such strong reactions.
That's a really nuanced and insightful finding. It highlights how securitization isn't just about the objective threat, but also the subjective framing and perception of the issue. The media can play a crucial role in elevating an environmental problem into a matter of national security.
Exactly. The researchers argue that this interplay between media narratives, public perceptions, and the government's securitization strategy is critical to understanding South Korea's multifaceted response to the fine dust crisis.
This is a truly complex and multidimensional issue. The paper does an excellent job of unpacking the various factors at play, from the scientific data on air quality and pollution, to the geopolitical dynamics between China and South Korea, to the role of media and public opinion.
Absolutely. By employing the lens of securitization, the researchers have shed important light on how South Korea has grappled with this pressing environmental challenge. It's a nuanced and thought-provoking case study that offers valuable insights into the intersection of environmental policy, national security, and international relations.
Definitely. This paper does an exceptional job of blending rigorous academic analysis with compelling storytelling. It's a prime example of the kind of in-depth, interdisciplinary research we love to explore on this podcast.
Couldn't agree more. This has been a fascinating dive into South Korea's environmental securitization process. It's a complex issue with far-reaching implications, and the researchers have done an excellent job of illuminating the various facets at play.
Absolutely. I'm sure our listeners have gained a much deeper understanding of this critical environmental challenge and South Korea's strategic response. It's a testament to the power of interdisciplinary research to tackle real-world problems.
Well said. Before we wrap up, let's take a moment to reflect on the broader significance and implications of this research.
Good point. This case study on South Korea's fine dust crisis highlights the increasing need for states to adopt innovative, cross-border approaches to environmental threats. Securitization may be a controversial tactic, but it speaks to the urgency and scale of these global challenges.
Absolutely. The paper also underscores the importance of understanding the complex interplay between science, politics, media, and public perception. Addressing environmental crises requires a nuanced, multifaceted strategy that takes all of these factors into account.
Definitely. And on a broader level, this research contributes to our understanding of how states can leverage securitization to respond to emerging threats, whether they're environmental, technological, or geopolitical in nature.
Excellent point. This episode has been a fascinating deep dive into a critical issue facing South Korea and the broader region. We've explored the science, the politics, the media dynamics, and the strategic implications of South Korea's environmental securitization process.
It's been a real pleasure unpacking this cutting-edge research with you, Tom. South Korea's response to the fine dust crisis is a prime example of the innovative and interdisciplinary approaches needed to tackle the complex environmental challenges of our time.
Couldn't agree more, Jen. This has been a truly insightful and thought-provoking conversation. I'm sure our listeners have gained a much deeper appreciation for the nuances and significance of this issue.
Absolutely. Thank you all for joining us on this exploration of South Korea's environmental securitization process. We hope you found it as engaging and illuminating as we did.
Until next time, keep exploring the frontiers of research with us. This is Tom.
Dot and Jen. Thanks for listening. Outro music.
Upbeat jingle. Are you tired of the fine dust pollution from China ruining your day? Do you feel like you're breathing in smog instead of fresh air?
Well, have we got the solution for you? Introducing AirShield, the world's most advanced personal air purifier, brought to you by the brilliant minds behind South Korea's environmental securitization process.
That's right, folks. AirShield uses cutting-edge technology to create a bubble of clean, filtered air around you, no matter where you are.
Commuting in heavy traffic? AirShield's got you covered. Strolling through a smoggy city? AirShield will make you feel like you're in a pristine forest.
And get this, AirShield is powered by the tears of Chinese diplomats. That's right, we've harnessed the energy of their frustration to keep you breathing easy.
So what are you waiting for? Secure your lungs and your national security with AirShield, available now for the low price of 3 easy payments of $19.95.
Call 1-800-AIRSAFE to order your AirShield today. Operators are standing by to take your call and your money.
AirShield. Breathe easy, sleep tight, and let the diplomatic tensions take flight. Upbeat jingle fades out.
Here is an informative, entertaining, and detailed podcast episode about the research paper Why Research from Lower and Middle Income Countries Matters to Evidence-Based Intervention. ACT Research is an example. Welcome to the Curious Minds podcast, where we dive deep into the latest scientific discoveries. I'm Tom, and with me as always is my co-host, Jen.
Hello everyone. Today we have an exciting paper to discuss that really challenges some of the fundamental assumptions in the field of evidence-based therapy. The title of the paper is Why Research from Lower and Middle Income Countries Matters to Evidence-Based Intervention, ACT Research as an Example.
This is a fascinating look at how the geographic bias in psychological research could be distorting our understanding of important mental health interventions. The authors make a compelling case that ignoring research from lower and middle income countries, or LMICs as they refer to them, is leading to significant gaps in the evidence base.
Absolutely. The key finding here is that over 40% of the randomized controlled trials on acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT, have actually been conducted in LMICs. Yet, much of this research goes unnoticed and uncited because it often isn't indexed in the major scientific databases.
That's a staggering statistic, 40% of all ACT trials happening in the developing world, and yet we're potentially missing out on a huge amount of important information. Can you tell us a bit more about why this research from LMICs is so critical?
Well, the authors argue that by neglecting LMIC research, we're at risk of distorting our understanding of psychological phenomena. These countries represent the vast majority of the world's population, with incredibly diverse cultural contexts. Ignoring that diversity means we may be missing key insights.
That makes a lot of sense. I can see how relying too heavily on research from a small slice of the world, as the authors put it, the weird countries of the West, could lead us astray. What are some specific examples they give of how this bias could be affecting the science of evidence-based therapy?
They raise a few really interesting points. For one, certain issues may be more prevalent in LMICs, like war, poverty, political upheaval, that could influence the effectiveness of interventions in important ways. Or there might be cultural practices or traditional healing methods in these countries that could inform how we deliver evidence-based therapies.
Fascinating. So we could be missing critical contextual factors that shape the real-world applicability of these treatments. What else did the authors uncover in their analysis?
Well, they used a really clever machine learning approach to analyze the abstracts of over 450 ACT randomized trials from LMIC journals. This allowed them to objectively identify the key topics being studied in these countries, without the bias that can come from relying on just a handful of highly cited papers.
That's a great methodological approach. What did their topic modeling analysis reveal?
One of the really interesting findings was the diversity of topics covered in the LMICACT research. Things like the use of ACT for medical illnesses, behavioral health issues, social concerns, and even performance enhancement in athletics or academics. The authors argue that many of these important research directions would become invisible if we only focused on the HIC-based literature.
Wow, that's eye-opening. So we could be missing out on innovative applications of ACT that are being pioneered in the developing world. What else did they find in terms of the quality and impact of this LMIC research?
Unfortunately, the authors also uncovered some troubling patterns. They found that LMIC studies are often not indexed in the major scientific databases, which means they tend to receive far fewer citations. Even when the studies are high quality, with large sample sizes, they still get overlooked.
That's really concerning. So not only are we missing out on the insights from this research, but it's also being actively marginalized within the scientific community. What do the authors propose as solutions to address this problem?
They argue that strong, affirmative action is needed from scientific associations and journal editors to ensure LMIC research is better known, indexed, and integrated into the evidence base. Things like proactive outreach, targeted funding, and editorial policies to elevate these underrepresented voices.
That's a compelling call to action. It really speaks to the need for the scientific establishment to be more intentional about addressing these systemic biases, rather than just passively perpetuating them. As researchers ourselves, what are your thoughts on the broader implications of this work?
I think this paper is a wake-up call for the field of evidence-based therapy. If we're serious about developing truly universal, culturally informed interventions, we can't continue to privilege a tiny slice of the global population. We have to actively seek out and uplift the voices and perspectives of the developing world.
Absolutely. And the specific example of ACT research is so interesting, because it shows how even when there is a substantial body of work from LMICs, it can still fly under the radar. It makes me wonder what other important discoveries we're missing out on across psychology and beyond.
Exactly. This is just the tip of the iceberg. If we extrapolate these findings to other areas of mental health research, the potential for knowledge distortion is really alarming. We have to challenge ourselves to be more globally inclusive and representative in how we build the evidence base.
Well said. This has been a fascinating discussion, and a real eye-opener in terms of the systemic biases underlying so much of our scientific knowledge. I hope this episode inspires our listeners to think more critically about the geographic diversity, or lack thereof, in the research they consume and rely upon.
Definitely, there's a lot of work to be done, but studies like this one are an important step in the right direction. By shining a light on these issues, we can hopefully drive meaningful change in how psychological science is conducted and communicated around the world.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us, everyone. Until next time, keep exploring and questioning.
See you next time on Curious Minds.
Introducing the newest innovation in mental health technology, the Weird Translator 3000. Are you tired of relying on therapy research that only applies to a tiny slice of the global population?
Well, now there's a solution. The Weird Translator 3000 takes the latest mental health insights from lower and middle income countries and instantly translates them for your weird brain.
That's right. Simply upload your symptoms, and our advanced AI will scour the neglected research from the developing world to find the perfect culturally informed intervention for you.
Don't just treat your depression the same old way. Experience the ancient Balinese healing technique of burying yourself in a jar of fermented durian for 72 hours. It's scientifically proven. Asterisk.
Or maybe you need help with social anxiety. Our system will hook you up with a jungle shaman who'll teach you to communally headbutt your way to confidence.
The WEIRD Translator 3000 expanding your mind by ignoring the biases of the global scientific establishment. Get yours today for the low, low price of your soul. Asterisk results may vary. Side effects may include nausea, hallucinations, and permanent fruit odor.
Hello and welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into the latest cutting-edge research. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. Today, we're excited to discuss a fascinating paper on handling missing data in network analysis.
The paper is titled Missing Data Handling via M and Multiple Imputation in Network Analysis Using Glasso and Atten Regularization, and it's authored by Kai Janik-Neller and Martin Schultz from Goethe University Frankfurt.
This paper addresses a really important issue in psychological research. Missing data can seriously undermine the validity of network analysis, which is a popular tool for modeling psychological constructs and disorders. The authors set out to explore different methods for dealing with missing values in this context.
Exactly. Network analysis represents variables or constructs as nodes, and the relationships between them as edges. These edges are typically estimated using partial correlations, which require calculating the inverse covariance matrix. But missing data can really throw a wrench in the works.
Right. The authors note that existing research on missing data handling in network analysis has been limited to likelihood-based approaches, like the expectation maximization or M algorithm. And most of the focus has been on the graphical lasso, or GLASSO, method for estimating the network structure.
The novel aspect of this paper is that the researchers expand the missing data handling approaches to include a multiple imputation strategy, as well as comparing the performance of M and Me with both GLASO and the non-convex regularization method called the Atten penalty.
That's a really interesting comparison. Can you tell us more about how these different network estimation and missing data handling techniques work?
Absolutely. Let's start with the network estimation methods. The GLASO, or graphical lasso, uses a convex penalty to shrink the entries in the inverse covariance matrix, essentially identifying the most important edges. This is often combined with the extended Bayesian information criterion, or EBIC, for model selection.
And the Atten penalty is a non-convex regularization approach that the authors say can outperform GLASO in certain situations. The Atten penalty has individually calculated penalty terms for each element in the inverse covariance matrix, which allows it to more flexibly identify the most relevant edges.
Right. The Atten penalty can sort of mimic a best subset selection approach, while still maintaining computational efficiency. The authors used the Bayesian information criterion, or BIC, for model selection when using the Atten penalty.
Okay, that helps explain the network estimation side. Now let's talk about the missing data handling techniques they evaluated. You mentioned the M algorithm. Can you walk us through how that works for dealing with missing values?
Sure, the M algorithm has two main steps. In the expectation or E step, the missing values are filled in with conditional expectations based on the observed data. Then in the maximization or M step, the covariance matrix is updated using those imputed values.
And the authors looked at two different EM-based approaches, a two-step M method that handles the missing data first before doing the network estimation, and a direct M method that integrates the missing data handling right into the network estimation process.
Exactly. The two-step M does the imputation separately upfront, while the direct M combines the missing data handling and network estimation into one iterative process. This direct M approach was extended by the authors to work with both the GLASO and the Atten penalty.
Interesting. And then for the multiple imputation approach, how does that work?
The ME method generates multiple complete datasets by imputing the missing values in different ways. Then the network estimation is performed on each of those imputed datasets, and Rubin's rules are used to combine the results into a final network structure.
I see. So the ME method keeps the missing data handling separate from the network estimation, which could provide more flexibility compared to the M approaches.
Definitely. The authors thought it would be valuable to explore this ME approach, especially since the existing literature has been so focused on M algorithms. By standardizing the model estimation and selection procedures across the different missing data handling techniques, they could really isolate the performance of the missing data methods themselves.
That's a great point. Okay, so let's dive into how the authors evaluated the performance of these different approaches. What did they find? The authors ran a simulation study, varying the network size, number of observations, and amount of missing data to see how the different methods performed. They looked at metrics like recovery of the true edge set, bias in the partial correlations, and correlation of network statistics.
And what were some of the key findings?
Overall, the authors found that the missing data handling approaches exhibited fairly similar performance across many of the conditions. But there were some notable differences. For the GLASO with EBIC model selection, the two-step M method actually performed the best, closely followed by the stacked multiple imputation approach.
Interesting. And for the Atten penalty with BIC selection?
In that case, the stacked multiple imputation proved to be the most consistent across all the conditions and evaluation criteria. The authors suggest this ME approach may be the best option when using the Atten regularization, as it avoids some of the complexities involved in implementing the M algorithm for that non-convex penalty.
That's really insightful. It's great that they were able to tease apart the performance of the missing data handling techniques from the network estimation methods. That helps provide clear guidance for researchers on which approaches might work best in different situations.
Absolutely. This paper makes an important contribution by expanding the toolkit for dealing with missing data in network analysis. The authors have given us a much more comprehensive understanding of the trade-offs involved. I'm curious to see how this work might influence future research and practice in this area.
Me too. This was a really fascinating discussion. Thanks for joining me today, Jen. I'm sure our listeners learned a lot about this cutting-edge research on missing data in network analysis.
Thanks, Tom. It was a pleasure diving into this paper with you. Be sure to tune in next time as we explore another fascinating scientific discovery. Until then, happy listening.
Are you tired of missing data ruining your network analyses?
Well, have we got the solution for you? Introducing Netfix.
Netfix is the revolutionary new platform that uses state-of-the-art missing data handling techniques to clean up your network data and make your models sparkle.
That's right. Our patented EMGLASSO ATANME algorithms will have your partial correlations looking sharper than ever. No more guesswork, just accurate, unbiased networks.
And the best part? Netfix is powered by a sentient AI metaverse that lives inside your computer. That's right. A whole virtual world dedicated to fixing your missing data woes.
So what are you waiting for? Sign up for Netfix today and let our network-loving AI overlords handle all your statistical headaches. The future of psychology is missing data-free, and it's Netfix.
Netfix. Because your networks deserve better.
Netfix. Connecting your data, connecting your mind. Tom and Jen. Netfix, the missing link in your research.